Thank you. So thank you for inviting me to come here to Perimeter to tell you a little bit about you know, what theoretical inferences we can draw from the gravitational wave detection. But now I guess I have to be more specific because there's two detections as of a few hours ago. So I have not changed all my slides. So I'm going to be mostly talking about the first LIGO detection that was made in September. Everything I want to say now will just become stronger if we add information from the second detection. So I think it's still relevant. Franz already gave, I guess, the first part of this talk where he was talking about the inferences we can draw on exotic objects and on ring down mode, so say test of the no-hair theorem with a gravitational wave event. I'm going to talk about other theoretical inferences we can draw from the in-spiral part of the gravitational wave signal. And if you want the technical details, they're all in this very, very long paper that's in the archive. Okay. Now, given that most of the audience is not an expert in gravitational wave physics, I thought I would give a brief introduction first of what I mean by extreme gravity, make this talk a little bit more didactic. So by extreme gravity, I here mean space-times that are not just strong, so we're not just sampling strong curvatures close to a black hole or close to a neutron star, but are also highly dynamical. So here you have a simulation of two black holes colliding. This is done by the RIT group, and you see that on a relatively short time scale, the gravitational field is changing violently, the curvature is very strong, and the curvature is changing drastically. Clearly, as you all know, these gravitational waves are produced by accelerating masses, so time-dependent multiple moments, quadruples, octuples, and so on. So here you see another simulation by the RIT group of two black holes with spins misaligned, orbiting around each other, and you see the spin vectors here with little blue and red arrows, hard to follow. And you see the arrows sort of change in direction because of precession of the spin vectors as the orbit proceeds. And down here you see the gravitational waves that get emitted in the process. And the gravitational waves get emitted in this regime of space and very far away from us where curvature is large, and then they propagate at the speed of light according to general relativity and interact very weakly with matter in between us and the source. With one over RDK, and that's why they're also very difficult to detect. Now, something I'm going to be using, and something that was actually referred to in previous talks, was the chirping feature of these gravitational waves. And what we mean by that is that the frequency actually increases with time, right? And you see that the separation of here to peaks is much smaller now than at the beginning of the simulation. And you can understand that simply via Kepler's law, so the frequency is proportional to square root of the mass divided by the separation cubed, and so we're talking about separations roughly of order of the mass, so you're talking about frequencies that scale as 1 over the total mass of the system. So neutron stars merge at about 1 kilohertz, 2 kilohertz, whereas black holes, depending on their mass, can merge at much lower frequency. Amount of radiation that was emitted for the GW150914 event was 3% of the rest mass, and that's enormous when you put it into actual units, you know, 1,000 times the energy emitted in a type 1A supernovae. Okay, so this is what we mean by extreme gravity, strong, nonlinear, dynamical. So how does this event, or this regime of space-time, compare relative to other regimes of space-time where we have done tests of general relativity? So here on the y-axis, we've plotted the radius of, well, the inverse of the radius of curvature, the x-axis, the field strength, or characteristic field strength for an experiment. So here we mean by m, a characteristic mass, and by l, a characteristic separation. Okay, so experiments that deal with the tracking of the LAGEO satellites in orbit around Earth are sampling this regime of this phase space. Similar with the tracking of the moon with lasers, these are all weak field tests, what I would call weak field tests of general relativity. Up until very recently, the most strong gravity test of GR we had was the double binary pulsar observation. And you can do several tests with the double binary pulsar. One of them is to observe the rate of change of the orbital period. So the orbital period is not constant. Double binary, it's emitting gravitational waves. So the period decreases due to the loss of energy. And you can measure that p dot and check that it's consistent with general relativity. A test like that would sit over here. But moreover, you can sometimes also see the photons emitted by one of the pulsars as they graze the surface of the other neutron star. Okay, and when that happens, or when it travels near the other neutron star, there's a Shapiro time delay. But this we've painted in cyan because it's not really a dynamical test of general relativity. It's more of tracking of null geodesics on this non-trivial space-time. Okay, for GW150914. Pulsar timing array, so the use of neutron stars to detect gravitational waves in the future would be measuring this regime of space-time. And for GW150914, you're measuring this regime right here. And notice that this is not a point. It's actually a set of points, because the separation is actually shrinking as you observe the event. What this does not convey is how dynamical, how rapidly, GW150914 goes from this point where it enters the band to merger. So to convey that, what we decided to do was to plot the radius of curve, well, the inverse of the radius of curvature here still, as a function of how dynamical the space-time is. So as a function of that time scale on which the radius of curvature is changing, or the potential is changing, or the binding energy is changing. It turns out all these time scales are the same. And so you see that 150914 is way over here. It has the shortest time scales, way shorter than the next most relativistic system, which is double binary pulsar, so like 15 orders of magnitude or so more dynamical. Okay, so now that we more or less understand what I mean by the extreme gravity regime, let me tell you what we can do regarding theoretical physics with an event that proves this regime. So I'm just dividing this talk into two parts. One which deals with the theoretical implications that a confirmation of general relativity forces on modified theories of gravity. And another one, because of this being a more cosmology-oriented workshop, or at least that's what I was told, what connections can we make between cosmology and extreme gravity? Okay, so this will be slightly more speculative and open to discussion. So let me begin with the inferences. I think Franz already showed this plot. It's a confirmation of general relativity. What you see here in gray is the data, and in red is the best fit model for this particular data set for GW150914. And so if I take the gray line and I subtract the red line, I get the blue line, which is the residual. And I can then ask whether that residual is consistent with the noise, that is consistent with the data in other segments of time where we know there's no gravitational wave. And the answer is yes. It's consistent with noise to at least 96%. And so that's what we mean by a 4% confirmation of general relativity. But is that it? Is that all we can do? We can just confirm general relativity and be done? I think the answer is no. We can do a lot more, because now that we know that that event is consistent with general relativity, everything else that we throw on top of general relativity has to be such that it leads to predictions in a merger of two black holes that are consistent with that piece of data. That piece of data is not going to go away, and it places a very high bar on theories, a bar that has to be passed. So one thing I can ask is, okay, if I have two black holes, painted blue, everybody knows black holes are blue. They could be emitting scalar, or they could have a scalar field that could activate, and this scalar field could be emitting, or could be propagating away from the system, inducing dipole radiation. Such a radiation would force this binary to spiral faster than general relativity predicts, and that is something that would be encoded in the gravitational wave. We can also ask whether vector modes get excited. This is typical of theories that, for example, violate Lorentz invariance, like Einstein ether theory. You can ask whether the possibility of parity being violated gravitationally leaves a signature in the gravitational waves that are generated here. And of course, this is all very close. This is the generation of gravitational waves. These are all effects that happen close to the binary, if you want. Of course, the waves then propagate, and very far away from the binary, so we are, Earth is, say, over here, okay? And we detect the waves over here, but there can be other effects that appear or accumulate as the waves propagate from the system to us. So for example, you can imagine, I'll get back to that in a second. You can imagine there being a wall, okay, where inside this wall, so on this part in the so-called near zone, so near the binary system, gravity is described as predicted by general relativity. So here you have GR, but outside of the wall you have modifications. Maybe you have some modified dispersion relation or something like that. So as the waves travel from this GR zone to this non-GR zone, then in principle you would expect modifications, and those are things you may be able to see. You can also have Lorentz violating effects due to the fact that different modes, tensor and vector modes, will be traveling at different speeds or obey different dispersion relations in these theories. This the picture here is my drawing for brain worlds. So if you have a brain world, if you believe in, say, Randall syndrome type models, then you can, in principle, have leakage of gravitons into the bulk, which would look like the mass of the objects is changing with time, which then would induce, due to this black hole evaporation, a signature in the signal. And whether you believe in that or not, or whether that's even possible or not, is a different question. Here we're remaining agnostic, and we're asking, given that the signal was consistent with GR, what does this imply on the non-existence of all of these effects? Okay? So it's best to divide or classify these inferences in inferences on effects that can activate in the generation of gravitational waves. So these are what I discussed earlier, scalar vector activations, parity violation, Lorentz violation, a possible time dependence of the gravitational constant or experimental leakage and so on. And what you want to constrain, perhaps, is not just each of these different mechanisms, but rather, violations to the fundamental principles upon which general relativity rests, that are, you know, those violations that that appear because of these introductions. So similarly, on the propagation side, you can talk about modified dispersion relations, modified kinematics. These are all effects that appear upon the propagation of the gravitational waves. So the principles that would be violated here are, of course, the space-time dimensionality, the parity invariance of general relativity, Lorentz violation, and these are, in some sense, also manifestations of the violation of the strong equivalence principle, okay? That experiments should satisfy local position invariance and local Lorentz invariance, and also satisfy the weak equivalence principle. On the other side, on the propagation side, you're really testing the idea that gravity or gravitons propagate at the speed of light. And this is tightly connected with the idea that perhaps gravitons have a mass. And of course, also Lorentz violation and SCP violation. So these inferences really allow you to test the fundamental pillars of GR. That's sort of the way I like to think about it. You have an observation that's consistent with general relativity, and then you ask, what does that mean in terms of possible violations on the basis upon which GR is constructed? Okay. Now, how do you do these tests? As Franz was saying, ideally you would want to have a parametrization of deviations from general relativity in the signal, in the gravitational wave signal, and that would be modifications that appear during the inspiral of two compact objects, as well as during the merger, and then in the ring down. But we don't know what happens in the merger. at all. So what you can do, however, is investigate what inferences you can draw from modifications in the ringdown and from modifications in the inspiral. So Franz talked about modifications in the ringdown. We don't know what to do in the merger. We're going to talk about now modifications during the inspiral. Even though the inspiral was short, over half of the SNR or so of the GW1509-14 event came from that very late inspiral. So in order to search for deviations from general relativity in the inspiral, we can use this post-Einsteinian framework that Franz and I proposed a few years ago, where we just say, imagine that you're in a modified theory of gravity. What will the Fourier transform or the response function of the gravitational wave look like? That's actually what LIGO is filtering for. And what we discovered was that indeed, the Fourier transform will be as predicted by GR, with potentially an amplitude modification and potentially a phase modification. So alpha and beta here are PPE parameters, very much like the PPN parameters you're used to from solar system tests, which, you know, are the quantities you want to constrain, alpha and beta. They are the magnitude of the effect. They are the quantities that, in principle, depend on the coupling constants of the theory that you're looking at. Whereas A and B here, these exponents, just control the type of modification you're introducing. So if you're introducing a scalar field that activates and induces dipole radiation, then B takes on a specific number, which happens to be -7/3 to leading post-Newtonian order. And so you can look at these different effects and classify what B has to be for each of these effects, and then pick a B and constrain beta, pick an A and constrain alpha. So here I am showing you what the different values of B are for different effects and different mechanisms that could be active in the generation of gravitational waves. So as I was saying, if you have scalar dipole radiation as induced, for example, by the appearance of a scalar monopole field around each compact object, then B is going to be equal to -7. Turns out, which is consistent with a -1 post-Newtonian order term, if you know what that means, and so on for the other effects. So a search strategy like this was first implemented at MSU by Cornish's group, who works on data analysis for LIGO, and then also implemented in a slightly different way by the NICAF group, who's also in LIGO, and I think the NICAF implementation is the one that is called TIGER, which is the one that's used in LIGO in the LSE to test general relativity. What do we do about the HGR? Well, we use the best approximation we have for the gravitational wave signal in general relativity. And this part is very much under control for black hole binary mergers. So you can use an effective one-body type H tilde here. You can use one of these phenomenological in spiral merger ringdown signals, and so on. Having said that, what can you say about constraints on different effects? So let me plot here constraints on beta as a function of the post-Newtonian order which they enter. Okay? So if something appears at -4 PN order, then it's related to some sort of anomalous acceleration, perhaps due to due to black hole evaporation in the presence of brain whorls or something like that. An effect at -1 PN order, at leading -1 PN order, would represent some sort of scalar dipole radiation. If you see something anomalous at 0 or at -1 PN order, that would be a sign of some sort of Lorentz violation in the signal. Something that appears at 2 PN order would be related to this gravitational parity violation. So the constraints you can, of course, we have not seen any of this, so we can constrain the emergence of any of these phenomena in the generation of gravitational waves by the following magnitudes. So the green and the red dots are the strengths that we can constrain with a GW1509 event. So anything above this red line is ruled out from that event. Everything above the black dashed line are constraints you can place from the double binary pulsar. Assuming these effects were present in the double binary pulsar. And just for kicks, I also included the blue dotted line, which is a prediction we made in 2011 using completely different, different masses and different SNRs. And, you know, it seems the prediction was pretty good. Yes. In any case, so everything that's above this line, this is an exclusion plot, gets essentially ruled out. So you see that binary pulsars are better at constraining this weaker gravity regime, whereas gravitational waves are better at constraining this stronger gravity regime. Of course, with the advent of the new observation and combining the new observation with this observation, this red line just moves down by roughly, I think, a factor of 5 to 10 or so, but we haven't done the calculation yet. So what does that mean on particular modified theories of gravity? So let's just take one example, this effective theory called Einstein-Dilaton-Gauss-Bonnet gravity, which introduces a scalar field that couples to the Kretschmann scalar at the level of the action, and it's massless. And you have to treat this as an effective theory, so you have to do perturbation theory about small deformations from general relativity for this to actually make sense. And if you calculate the gravitational wave, it looks like the gravitational wave in GR plus this correction, where beta turns out to be a function of the coupling constants of the theory times a function of the masses and the spin. So chi A here is the dimensionless spin of the eighth body, so the spin angular momentum divided by the mass of that body squared. That's what SA is as a function of chi, and here you have M1 and M2. So you see that if the masses are very similar and the spins are very similar, then you can find, you can find a combination of the masses and the spins where this effect could vanish, unless you've measured the spins very, very well. Unfortunately, for GW15 and 914, the spins were not constrained very well. The posteriors were actually quite wide. So if you explore the posteriors with these quantities, you can find regions in the posterior where this effect goes away completely. So that's a strong degeneracy between this modification and the spin and the masses of the bodies, which means that you cannot really place a constraint on that coupling constant. You cannot map between the constraint on beta to constraint on the coupling constant of the theory in this particular case because of those strong degeneracies. The same turns out to be true about a coupling constant that appears if you allow for black holes to have scalar hair due to, for example, cosmological boundary conditions, as well as in dynamical Chern-Simons gravity, which is another one of these effective field theories that model gravitational parity violation. Constraints on Lorentz invariants due to, for example, in Einstein constraining parameters in Einstein ether theory are strong, but not stronger than what you can do with the double binary pulsar. But what I should emphasize here is that even though these numbers are larger than these numbers, these constraints come from an entirely different regime of space-time. They come from the merger of two black holes, whereas these constraints come from two neutron stars that are widely separated, just moving around each other. So the field strength and the dynamical nature of gravity in this regime is much weaker than in this regime. So in some sense, these constraints are complementary. Okay. Now you can move on into gravitational wave propagation and ask, what does GW150914 imply on mechanisms that could have been active in the propagation of gravitational waves? So one way to do this is to consider the dispersion relation of gravitational waves. Those are the only modes we see. So the energy of the energy of a graviton square will be equal to the momentum of the graviton square, plus, in principle, some A that you want to constrain times P to the alpha. So for example, when alpha is equal to 0, A is essentially a rewriting of the mass of the graviton. Okay, from like a special relativity relation in a very simple kinematical way. And if you take that dispersion relation and you calculate the group velocity, you find that it satisfies this. So it deviates from 1. And so when alpha is larger than 1, if A is positive, you have superluminal propagation of tensor modes, whereas if A is negative, you have subluminal propagation of tensor modes. So then you can ask, can I constrain positive A and negative A as a function of alpha? And the answer is yes. And in fact, different values of alpha picked here will correspond to different modifications to gravity in the propagation of gravitational waves. So a standard, Cliff Wheel-style kinematical massive gravity modification would look like an alpha of 0 and A of the mass of the graviton squared. Alphas of 2 and 3 will correspond to something called multifractal spacetimes. Alpha equal 3 will correspond to doubly special relativity, and alpha equal 4 would be something like Chavez-Lipschitz gravity or extra-dimensional effects. And so then you ask, okay, we have not seen any deviation from the standard GR dispersion relation in GW 150914. So how small must A be in order to be consistent with a statistical error in our observations? And what you find is the following. So LIGO, in their paper, placed a constraint at alpha is equal to zero, which is this constraint on the mass of the graviton that was quoted in their paper, which is stronger than the constraints you can place from solar system observations. But you can, of course, do this for other alpha. And so you see the constraints on other alpha here in red, as well as the LIGO constraint in green, as well as an approximate constraint you can derive analytically in blue, which I'm not actually going to discuss here. At the same time, if you have a superluminal propagation or subluminal propagation, you can actually constrain the speed of gravity by taking into account that there's two LIGO instruments. There's one in Hanford and there's one in Livingston, and they detect the gravitational waves with a time offset. So if gravity is moving or propagating faster than the speed of light, that time offset would have been different than what it was observed by LIGO. And that is a constraint placed here by Blass in magenta. And other constraints from cosmic ray observations are here in blue. So the point is that with this new gravitational wave observation, you're really ruling out a very large regime of parameter space in terms of gravitons propagating at speeds different than the speed of light. Sort of cool. So now that I've discussed this, let me just move on to connections between cosmology and extreme gravity. Now, as I was saying, there's generation effects that appear very close to the binary, but the binary in principle is very, very, very far away from Earth. So if you imagine that there is some sort of screening due to cosmological effects, you can imagine that in this regime, gravity is as described in GR, and in this regime, gravity is as described in GR, but maybe on large scales, it's not as described in GR. So then what would happen if you have a gravitational wave that's emitted from this system? So it would propagate as in GR up to this wall and then transition somehow from that to propagating differently than predicted in GR. And then when it re-enters, it would re-enter propagating as in GR, but it would have built up this modified effect as it travels from one wall to another wall. Okay. So then a question is, can gravitational wave propagation constrain these Weinstein-style screening mechanisms? And I'm not postulating that Weinstein screening is a great idea or that it's well posed or anything like that. I'm just taking an agnostic point of view and asking, if these effects were there, can you see it or not? And that's work that I think could be done rather easily, and I think there's people actually working on it now, right now. A question you might have is, why is it that these propagation effects that might actually have something to say about cosmological large scales, small redshift but still, why are they much stronger than the effects that may appear during the generation of gravitational waves? So in order to understand that, let's consider this massive graviton theory that Will likes to study. And there you know that the correction to the propagation of gravitational waves due to a modified dispersion relation enters with this power of the velocity. So pi mf to the 1/3 is roughly the velocity of the binary. So it enters with a power of -1. And it's proportional to this beta propagation that is a function of the Compton wavelength of the graviton and other parameters. Whereas due to the generation of gravitational waves, there will also be a correction, and that correction will scale with a different power of pi mf, with a different power of velocity. So these two effects will enter at different post-Newtonian orders. So if pi mf is small, which it is in the inspiral regime, you would expect this term to be much larger than this term, right? Because it's raised to a more negative power. What that doesn't take into account is that this effect, due to this coefficient, builds up with distance that the gravitational wave propagates by. Okay? So if you actually take the ratio of these two quantities and plug in numbers, you find that the propagating effect, even though it's a lower post-Newtonian order effect, sorry, a higher post-Newtonian order effect, is 10 to the 18 times larger than what happens in the generation of gravitational waves. So this is a very simple example of why propagation effects can really build up and really dominate modifications to the waveform, and therefore allowed for much stronger constraints on modified gravity. But you can also go the other way around. Instead of trying to inform cosmological modified theories with extreme gravity, you can ask, can cosmology tell us something about the modified theories of gravity we should be investigating in the extreme gravity regime with gravitational waves? Like Franz was saying, there's lots of weeds, and you need to whack those weeds somehow. And so maybe cosmology can act as a weed whacker. You know? So let's just consider as an example scalar tensor theories. So this is a class of scalar tensor theories introduced by Damour and Esposito-Ferrese. You have a massless scalar field, phi, that in the Einstein frame couples to matter through this exponential conformal coupling, where beta is a number. Okay? And if you vary the action with respect to the fields in the theory, the evolution equation for the scalar field satisfies this equation, whereas the field equations are just the standard Einstein equations, but the right-hand side also acquires a contribution due to the stress energy of the scalar field. So let's just concentrate on this equation and ask, are there strong field effects that arise, say, in extreme gravity environments? In the solar system, you would expect that, you know, T matter rho of the solar system is very small, so this right-hand side would be maybe very small, so then box phi, you know, will just be, you know, a constant plus another constant divided by R, and there won't be a scalar charge. Effectively, there won't be a modification in the solar system. This theory should pass solar system constraints, or so you might think. But, you know, in regimes where T matter is large, there might be some nonlinear effect that might induce a growth of scalar field. And indeed, if you consider the exterior solution outside of a neutron star, then box phi is equal to zero, and the solution looks like that, where alpha is a constant and m is the mass of the star. And that constant has to be determined by matching the solution to this equation at the surface of the neutron star. Okay, so you solve this equation in the interior of the neutron star, and then you match it at the surface to this solution, and that's how you get this alpha. And so you can then, for a given central density and a given, therefore, mass of the neutron star, you can calculate what this alpha is. And that's what I'm going to show you here. It's a set of numerical simulations that Damour and Esposito-Ferrese did that compute alpha for a bunch of different neutron stars. So every point here is a different isolated neutron star solution that they constructed. It's a function of the baryonic mass. And what you see is that, effectively, the scalar charge is zero until it reaches a threshold baryonic mass where the compactness is large enough to activate a nonlinear effect and allow for a rather large scalar charge. The presence of scalar charges in neutron stars, so a scalar field that's anchored to the density of a neutron star, will then induce dipole radiation when you have two of these objects moving around each other. If you have dipole radiation, then the binary will shrink faster than in general relativity, and that's going to lead to a large effect that will modify your observations, yet be a theory that's consistent with general relativity in the weak field. So different in the strong field or in the extreme gravity regime, the same in the weak field. But in reality, by the way, this is called spontaneous scalarization, okay, because sort of spontaneously turns on. But in reality, in order to determine whether solar system constraints are passed, what you have to calculate is, for example, the PPM parameters. And in this particular theory, the PPM parameters are a function of this beta constant, which is a coefficient in the theory, times the value of the scalar field today. You cannot assume that the value of the scalar field today is zero. That's cheating. What you have to do is you have to evaluate or solve for the evolution of the scalar field with some initial conditions, say at inflation, and then cosmologically evolve that scalar field to the present. Now, we know that this quantity has to be smaller than roughly 10 to the minus 5 because of the tracking of the Cassini spacecraft, which has confirmed general relativity to be right, in particular Shapiro time delay observation of that signal. So we know that whatever the cosmological evolution of the scalar field is, it has to satisfy this inequality. Otherwise, it would violate solar system constraints. So what is the value of the scalar field today? What you want to do is you want to solve the evolution equation for the scalar field cosmologically. So omega here is the equation of state parameter in cosmology, depending on which era you're in, what the stress energy component you're considering. And what you realize is that this looks a lot like a harmonic oscillator with a potential that looks like beta times phi squared. So this would be like the gradient of the potential. So if beta is larger than zero, then your potential is convex, meaning it looks like a happy face. So if you start anywhere on that potential, assuming the velocity of the field is not very large, the field will just roll down and settle to the minimum of the potential. Since the minimum of the potential is at zero, then phi today is going to be zero, and gamma minus one will be very, very, very small, and therefore this constraint will be passed. Great. Problem is that this value of beta does not allow for spontaneous colorization. The only values of beta that allow for spontaneous colorization in this theory of the Moran's positive fluorescence are negative values of beta. And when you have negative values of beta, this potential is concave, so unhappy, which then means that phi will just roll down this upside down parabola and just actually approach an attractor solution, which will in fact maximally violate solar system constraints. So you can't have both. You can't have scalarization and passing solar system constraints in the standard naive vanilla Damour's positive fluorescence theory. And this is an example of how, you know, cosmological evolution, or taking into account the cosmology effects in modified theories of gravity, can tell us something about which modified theories of gravity are worth looking at in the extreme gravity regime. Now, just as a side note, that does not mean that the Damour's positive fluorescence theory in general cannot allow for scalarization and pass solar system constraints. For example, you could add a mass to the scalar field, or you can make the theory more complicated, and maybe if you do that, you'll be able to get both properties on at the same time. But that has not quite been demonstrated entirely yet, although there's work in that direction. Okay. So I don't know, how much time do I have, Kurt? 10 minutes? Okay. Good. So I wanted to leave you all with this outlook of where I think we are headed. You know, GW150914 has provided the first consistency test of general relativity, and the new event that was announced this morning allows you to place even stronger consistency requirements on modified theories, and that in turn places constraints on different modified gravity models. It forces inferences on theoretical mechanisms that we know are not present around black hole binaries. So in particular, you can get new bounds on, for example, these theories, bounds that these theories must now satisfy. Now, obviously, these constraints will become much stronger, not only because there will be more detections, and I swear this light was here before the detection this morning. You will also see more events with higher SNR. So remember, LIGO in its original 01 run was effectively operating at 30% capacity. So as it's improved, as new engineering runs are done and the sensitivities increase, so the spectral noise density goes down, you will detect not only more events, but also some events with even a higher signal-to-noise ratio. Because the constraints you can place on modified theories scale inversely with a signal-to-noise ratio, then these constraints will also increase, not just due to stacking of posteriors, but also due to single events leading to more stringent constraints. In principle, also, as you see other systems like neutron star, neutron star binaries, you'll be able to constrain other physical effects that may not be present in binary black hole space depths. So there are theories of gravity where gravity is exactly the same in vacuum, because a version of the no-hair theorems still applies, so black hole solutions in these theories may still be Kerr or Schwarzschild. But as soon as you put in matter, like neutron stars, then new effects appear, like the activation of a scalar field. And those are things we cannot constrain with black hole binaries, but we can with neutron star binaries in the future. And also, interestingly, the hope is that at least with so many detections that supposedly are coming in the very near future, one of these might have an electromagnetic counterpart. I'm not talking about many, I'm just one, okay? What would be an electromagnetic counterpart? Well, if you have two neutron stars that merge, then these two neutron stars might produce a short gamma ray burst. And if this short gamma ray burst is in such an orientation such that the cone of the GRB is sort of aimed at Earth, then you might see the electromagnetic signal together with a gravitational wave signal. That would allow you to break the degeneracies and in principle place a really strong constraint on the speed of gravity, which in turn would place very strong constraints on violations of Lorentz invariance, for example, in Einstein ether theory. And I think a very exciting frontier for more interplay is between, you know, these cosmological theories and these extreme gravity theories. Because it is not just that the theories have to pass solar system constraints now, it's that they should also satisfy cosmological observations and extreme gravity observations. So it's a much higher bar than we had before. And so since I wanted to leave lots of time for questions, I think I will stop here. Thank you.
Questions?
Sorry, I have a question about the scalar tensor gravity. I don't know whether you have checked the possibility that if you change the sign of the kinetic energy term for the scalar part, does that compatible with the GR test? And the other one is, what happens if you have a flat potential for the scalar field?
Right. So when you say scalar tensor gravity, that's not a very specific sentence. But if you're
okay,
talking about.
Let's go to the action that you.
Yeah. So if you're talking about specifically the Damouris positive for SI1.
Yeah. So let's change the sign.
So I think if you change the sign of the kinetic term, you might be unstable. I think the Hamiltonian may not be bounded from below. So that just causes all sorts of problems, which you want to avoid. So I've not seen a study that does that and then places constraints on the sign of this coefficient. And if the potential is flat, do you mean this conformal coupling here if it's one? If the coupling is one, so if beta is zero, then this reduces to a scalar scalar Einstein system, and then there's no scalar here that gets produced by neutron star solutions or by any type of stellar configuration, so there would be no bounds that you could place from, say, dipole radiation or things like that.
So I had one question. So in the case of a ordinary graviton mass, naively I would think the bound that you could place on the mass would be roughly the distance from where the merger is to where we are, but the bounds you show are much weaker than that. Is there a reason?
Right. So the effect will scale roughly with, say, the Compton wavelength divided by the distance that the thing travels, and then there's a coefficient that also, in principle, determines how sensitive this, or how well this effect has been constrained. And so that coefficient is where the signal-to-noise ratio enters and other properties of the signal enter. If you convert the constraint on beta to a constraint on lambda, okay, then I think the constraint on lambda will definitely scale with the distance traveled. So that means that as we see more systems that are farther out, we're going to be able to place stronger and stronger constraints. Although, you know, you're talking about an increase in a factor of three in signal-to-noise ratio, so roughly a factor of three.
The constraints you showed were many orders of magnitude less than this distance.
Oh, well, and where?
Where you were showing the...
This?
Earlier, where you had the plot of the various dispersion relations.
This?
Yeah, I think that one.
Oh, I see. So this is a constraint, oops. Darn. This is a constraint on A. It's not a constraint on, say, the Compton wavelength or the graviton. So the D has not been factored in yet. So what you would need to do, since what you need to do is you need to map this correction to the observable that you're seeing. And when you look at the observable, then it's not just A that appears in the phase, but also the distance. So you need to multiply this constraint that you're placing here by the distance with the right, you know, with the appropriate power to get the constraint of Compton wavelength that, say, LIGO quoted.
Even that to me, usually for constraining this kind of doubly special relativity effect, one has to go.
I can't hear you, Anthony.
So given that usually, you know, to constrain this kind of new physics or doubly special relativity, one has to go looking at the highest photon in gamma ray bursts, right? So these are this wavelength actually are very large, right? So the energy is very low. So do you expect in the future that the increase in the sensitivity will be effective for this kind of measurement, or is just the fact that you're cross-correlating with the other things, just like gamma ray bursts, that will give you some information? Because of course from here people, I don't think, are expecting too much information on those things.
Right, so there's two things. So constraints to a modified dispersion relation on the gravitational sector alone, forget about the photon sector, are very few and rare, right? Because it's hard to measure the dispersion relation of gravitons. So in that sense, these are essentially new constraints. So we expect those constraints, you know, modifications to be PRG scaled, and obviously no. And will those constraints get better? Yeah, they will get better, probably by factors of, you know, initially factors of 3, maybe 10 as the signal to noise ratio increases. If we go crazy and start stacking lots of loud systems, maybe a factor of 100. But what's going to really get you better constraints is as you detect systems that are farther and farther out. So if you have more advanced detectors that can see at higher redshift, then there's more time, if you want, for the wave to propagate, and that will build up to factors of 100 to 1,000. Now, if you have an electromagnetic counterpart, then you can remove some degeneracies in the gravitational wave signal, because you know, for example, that the system had to be sort of face on, because otherwise the short gamma ray burst would not have been pointing at you. And that in turn allows you to break the degeneracy in the extraction of parameters, which leads to constraints on the Einstein ether Lorentz violating parameters that are about 10 orders of magnitude better than what we can do today. Now, there, you know, what is the expected magnitude of Lorentz violation is sort of unclear, especially in Einstein ether theory, but an improvement in 10 orders of magnitude, I think, just by itself is interesting. But for that, we have to wait maybe 1 or 2 more years.
There are models that screen for the little gamma Eddington parameter. The denser the sources, the more the screening is. There's chameleon models, Corey, Brax, and so on, that screen the scalar field for the solar system, for example, or the Earth. What do you think about them?
What do I think about screening mechanisms that, you know, screen the scalar field in the solar system?
Effective potential.
Yeah, so I have not studied enough those systems to be able to give you a personal opinion of what I think about those models, although I think Justin is here. He can give you his opinion. Regardless of that, just remaining purely agnostic, if there is a screen in the solar system and a screen in, say, black hole binaries, for sure there won't be a screen in some regimes of space-time as the gravitational waves propagate these long distances. And if that is true, then that should leave a signature in the observable. And that's my point of view. That's sort of the conclusion I take from this. If there is an effect that's large enough because of accumulation of a modification during this propagation, then that's something that in principle gravitational waves can see.
It should show up in the wave.
Yeah, in the face in particular.
Okay, let's thank Nico again.
Thank you.
Thank you.